The United Nations Agency for Maritime is the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, and it made as its focus event for this year empowering women in maritime and gender equality in the maritime industry. We well know that maritime is a predominantly male profession at this time, which is missing out on hugely in diversity, in numbers, and all the benefits of having a better and integrated society. Worldwide, about 1.5 million seafarers, of whom 2% are women, and the overwhelming majority of them are in the cruise industry, something like 94%. When you come to Australia, there are around about 5,600 seafarers in Australia, of whom 5% are women in seagoing roles. Now, a number of organisations in Australia have taken on board that they need to improve that and bring women forward and into the maritime industry. Among them, of course, is the Nautical Institute, which we represent. The Nautical Institute being that international body of maritime professionals, both qualified seafarers and those with an interest in maritime, and works at improving their position and their professionalism, and also has a seat at the IMO. Now, we of the Southeast Australia branch of the Nautical Institute have taken on our focus as being empowering women in maritime, and that's been largely initiated and driven by my predecessor as chairman and the vice president of the Nautical Institute, Gillian Carson Jackson. So this evening we have three accomplished women in maritime: Gillian Carson Jackson, who I've just introduced, Captain Josephine Clark, Ports of New South Wales in Port Kembla, and Captain Joe Kenyon, Ports of New South Wales in
Jackie Kenyon,
Ports of New South Wales in Sydney. Yes, thank you very much. So I'll invite you just to give a few words about yourself, your background, and then we'll talk about past, present, and most of all, future in maritime.
Excellent. I'll start off. My name is Gillian Carson Jackson, and as you can tell by my accent, I am not Australian. I started off my career as an officer cadet right out of high school at the age of 17. I decided I wanted something a bit different, and so I joined the Canadian Coast Guard, and I graduated from the Canadian Coast Guard cadetship program doing navigation. So I spent most of my time on board ship doing search and rescue, buoy tending, ice breaking, lots of time in the Canadian Arctic, lots of ice, very cold, unlike here. My career took me from the seagoing Canadian Coast Guard to the shore role, where I did search and rescue and vessel traffic services. And then I moved into teaching at the Canadian Coast Guard College, and then I went to France to work for IALA. Hands up, who knows what IALA is? IALA, I love this audience, they actually know it. The International Association of Marine Aids to Navigation and Lighthouse Authorities. And I was a technical coordination manager for IALA, living in Paris for 4 years, when somebody from Australia, his name was Clive Davidson, anybody remember Clive Davidson? Used to be head of the Australian Maritime Safety Authority. He invited me to come to Australia and work on vessel tracking, the regulating of the coastal pilotage program, implementing the undercarrier clearance program, and also vessel traffic services. So I was honored to work for AMSA for about 10 years before I went off on my own. And I did the typical maritime thing. I became a consultant. So I am now a maritime technical consultant, and I'm teaching here right now, back in my roots at Vessel Traffic Services. So that's a little bit about how I came to where I am. I am, as Captain Wren has said, I'm the past secretary and also the past chairman of the branch of the Nautical Institute. I am currently the senior vice president of the Nautical Institute. And on the 1st of July 2020, in Plymouth, I am set to be inaugurated into the role of president of the Nautical Institute, which is an honorary role, I stress to say. I'm not moving to London. It's an honorary role for 2 years, and I will become the first female president of the Nautical Institute, showing the significant support for women in maritime that the Nautical Institute has, and that's support for women in the professional roles of seagoing and also shore-based roles. That's a quick one. Is that okay?
Captain Josephine Clark.
I was going to say, Gillian, Joe, and Jackie. No yeah. one knew mixed it
up. I'm a mere male. Sorry.
My name's Joe Clark. I'm a limited marine pilot at Port Kembla in New South Wales, which is Port Authority of New South Wales. I've been there for 7 years now. Prior to that, I was the harbour master and pilot down in the Port of Eden, New South Wales, for 6.5 years. Prior to that, I was at sea on merchant ships for 16 years. I commenced in 1989 with a cadetship with BHP Transport, as it was back then. I was very fortunate to enter the industry during the MIDC era, when we still had four strong coastal companies taking a good, healthy number of cadets and trainees every year. I was lucky to enter the second year of the TIR program, if probably many of you know what that is, and spent the subsequent 12 years with BHP, working through their fleet of bulk carriers and on some of their managed ships, being LNG, chemical and self-discharging bulk carriers. Then there was a bit of a downturn in Australian flag in sort of 80, people would remember 99, 2000, 2001, and many, many ships went off the coast. I went ashore into a chartering secondment with BHP for just under 2 years at that time, but then moved back to Australia and went back to sea with ISM, as it was at that time, Inco Ships, as it's called now, for a subsequent 4 years. I was fortunate enough to get promoted through to master with that company, and then from there into my first pilotage role in Eden. And here I am now. That's a brief summary.
Captain Jackie Kenyon.
Thanks. Hi, so my name's Jackie Kenyon. I'm currently a marine pilot in Sydney and Botany Bay. I had a bit of a different start to my career than Joe. When I was 18, I joined the Royal Australian Navy. Oh, sure, no worries.
Chief engineer
here is having trouble. There's a seat up front for you if you'd like to join us up front. We actually do have another seat if you'd like to come and sit. There's a couple of seats in here.
Before I started as a pilot, I was in the Royal Australian Navy. I first went to sea in 2002 when I was 18. And I ended up staying in the Navy for 17 years before I joined the Port Authority at the start of this year. When I was in the Navy, I specialised in navigation and ship handling, and I served on a variety of different types of ships. So I served in tankers, ro-ro vessels, frigates, and survey ships and large amphibious craft. I saw service in the Middle East, got to travel through some great parts of the world, and my last couple of years at sea, I was the navigating officer of the landing helicopter dock ship, the HMAS Adelaide, which was the biggest ship that the Navy had ever built and had in service. It was a twin Azipod ship, so it was really good to learn a different type of propulsion system from conventional single screw. And then I started as a pilot in February this year. I gained my first license in July, and so now I'm in the process of working through all the license levels until I become an unlimited pilot for the two ports in Sydney and Botany Bay.
Now, what I propose is I have a series of prepared questions, but you in the audience may also have your questions. So I'll ask a question, I'll ask if anybody else has one, then I'll go on. But we do need to keep moving it on to get value from it. Yes. So I'll just put to you, and I'll say, who most enabled you to progress in your maritime career, and what influence did you think this had on the way that you work with others now?
Can we
can start with you, please.
I don't think I can put it down to any one person that had the greatest influence. I had quite a few people that really influenced me early on in my career. And I think they did that by encouraging and supporting me through my training and through my career to be, I guess, the best that I could be at whatever I was working towards. I guess the way that's influenced me is in the way that I used to train people that worked for me. I used to try to take quite a collaborative approach with training and letting people learn from their mistakes and building their confidence as they went on, so that they could learn from themselves and build their own confidence in themselves without having someone else do everything for them.
And that's the balance between mentoring and coaching. And
Josephine. Yeah, same as Jackie. You can't really mention just one person. Obviously, I think everyone at SEA's had some fantastic mentors, whether they be masters, chief officers, or bosuns, as you're going through your certificates and experience. I think I was fortunate to have two sort of what I consider to be big jumps in my career. I always think the management team at ISM to promote me to master at the time they did was a big leap of faith from Andrew Daly and Ian Ives at the time in that company. And then years later, when I came ashore into the Harbour Master Pilot role in Eden, which looking back, I was probably very young and green, a first shore-based position, first port-based position, and first government position was a big leap of faith from Tony Middleton and Kel Dillon in those years, but fortunately went okay. Yeah, I think, again, similar to Jackie, I think now I'm in the position where I get to supervise people in an operational sense when they're going through their pilotage training and licences. And, I think it's having confidence in people, particularly people that show a lot of ability. You see it there. They just need to get the runs on the board. And, letting them go as far as you can, seeing them, you have to go through the process to learn, and not trying to once again micromanage or direct them from behind.
And Julian,
I'm a little bit different. I think I'm a bit of a contrary sort of person. Back in the 1980s in Canada, women in shipping, women on board ship were not well regarded at all. And my first cadetship at the age of 18, when I joined my first ship, I had so much pushed against me as to why I shouldn't be there. I'd have newspaper articles left on my bunk to say why women shouldn't be on ship. I had an umbrella I had taken on board the ship. Apparently that's bad luck on a ship. I didn't know, so they threw it overboard. I was given flowers for my birthday. I never saw them. They threw them overboard because that's bad luck. And everything that they could possibly do to get me off the ship made me want to stay that much more because I'm a little bit contrary. So in a way, that push against me being on the ship actually made me want to stay more and to prove that I could do it. So that was a very strong driver, because I was in this industry and I wanted to prove that I could do it and I could be just as good as a man, which is actually, now I look back on it, we'll get into that, probably not the best thing to do, but it meant that I stayed in an industry where many of my cadet colleagues did not. We had 120 start as cadets and we had 60 graduate. Both men and women were pushed out at that time. We don't do that now in Canada. We train for success, but at that time in the 80s, I think the push was against that. But back at the college, we had some amazing instructors who were they made it much better. When you got off sea phase and you went off the cadet ship into the college for more training, we had a wonderful and amazing array of instructors. And one of whom was really, I think, one of the people I could pinpoint the reason why I joined Maritime, a gentleman by the name of Terry McCluskey, an Irishman with very bad jokes and even worse beer. He made his own. It was always a good week. It was never very old. But he was the one who talked me into joining the Coast Guard when they did their round Canada trip to meet people to try and bring them into the Canadian Coast Guard. And so I'd say he would have been probably a very key point in my life to promote me and to make sure that I joined the maritime industry. But the reason why I stayed was actually just to be ornery, to say, yes, I'm here, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying.
Ornery is a real good Canadian word as well. As well. Moving more technical now, technology has undoubtedly changed a lot and changed the way you do your job. What opportunities are there for training in the digital and technical skills required now to upgrade yourself with technology? Jackie.
Why don't you set Joe first?
Joe. Yes.
I always go to Jackie first, that's not fair.
Technology has changed enormously over the years, particularly in pilotage training. You think about the amount of full mission-based simulation training we do these days compared to probably even 5 or 10 years ago. It's increased immensely, not only with your periodic training and your initial licensing, but also with port development work when they're assessing new channels, new berths, whatever, within the harbour, which is a massive advantage compared to 10 years ago when it wasn't nearly as available. I consider we're in a bit of a transition era at the moment. Maybe we're a 10 or 15 year phase where we're moving from what in the aviation field we might call VFR pilotage, where we all do it basically visually with some radar and nav aids, and moving ahead another 8 or so years, it'll be fundamentally electronic, I think, the IFR as they do in aviation. I think it's a real, we're on the cusp of a change of era here where the old doing it by eye is no longer acceptable or even realistic in some of the manoeuvres that have been done in port. So we're sort of in a very much a transition phase where the technology's there, but the technology is very diverse. It's not, my bugbear in life is lack of standardisation, but I think I'll be retired before we have a S mode enacted. So at the moment we're in a dangerous transition phase where the culture and the mentality of many people is still visual navigation, but the technology is there, so the technology is perhaps ignored or misused or just confusing due to the so many different arrays that are available on board ship.
I think some of the pilots here might have a question on that.
Yeah.
But Jackie, you will, when you trained with the Navy, you had full mission simulators there for your vessels.
Yeah.
Does that translate over into your current job, or what supplementary training in instrumentation, for example, do you get now?
A lot of that translates across to my current job. However, since I've started, we've done quite a lot of full mission simulations as well, which I think has been, you know, great for training to be able to, for the repetition that you can do the same manoeuvre over and over again within that short amount of time frame, not having to wait, you know, maybe 2-3 weeks till another ship going to that berth becomes available. You can, I think with that type of training, you can get a lot more out of it in a short amount of time.
Is there the capability to do that if you know you're taking a ship to a berth in Sydney Harbour? Can you say, okay, well, I'm going to give that a go on the simulator, and is that available to you, that option?
So, I guess not readily available. The simulators, so we use up in Brisbane or down in Launceston, so there's not one that we can just drive 30 minutes down the road to. And it just depends on what ship as to whether the ship model exists in that simulator.
Julian, you are an educator, including the person who wrote the book on simulation, which I have in my library.
I'm so pleased you do. Yes, I wrote a book on simulation instructor training because I was very concerned that many trainers were being taught how to use a simulator but not how to use it effectively for training. It's interesting you mentioned about a simulator down the road. There's one right up there. It's a bridge simulator right here. We have bridge simulation, vessel traffic services simulation, maritime communications, GMDSS simulation, right in this very building, so it's kind of exciting. It is quite new. It only just opened recently. But go back to your original question with regards to digitization as a whole, not just in training, but digitization as a whole. And we are in a digital transformation of the maritime industry. And one of the questions that I have, and I put out to the audience, and I will be putting out in the presidential questionnaire looking for the Nautical Institute, what is a maritime professional in an increasingly digital environment? What are the skill sets that we need for maritime professionals? I don't have the answers. I'm hoping that we'll be able to have a discussion to come up with some solutions. And it might be that we're looking more into IT technology and into the ability to recognize bugs in software compared to the ability to lay a course off on a chart and do a cocked hat and do horizontal sextant angles, which is what I learned. And that's how we laid buoys, was horizontal sextant angles. Didn't even have GPS. I mean, I am feeling old. But this whole concept, what is a maritime professional in an increasingly digital environment? And it is getting more digital. The World Radio Conference, the International Telecommunications Union, is the UN-sanctioned body that governs radio frequencies. The World Radio Conference ended last week, and at the end of the World Radio Conference, they agreed to spectrum available for a digital VHF data exchange system. So we have now the ability to do digital communications in the VHF maritime mobile band up to satellites, like AIS, but much more, but also from satellites down. So what's the implication? Don't know yet, but this is where we're at right now. As I think you said it really well, we're on this cusp of a complete change, almost into that dangerous area, because we have all this digital equipment there and expectations from the public that we are using digital aspects, but yet we have an environment and a training regime that's structured on more analog approaches to this navigation. So yes, it's a really exciting time to think about the digital environment, and I look forward to further discussions on this.
There is a need for maritime professionals these days to develop soft skills and understand safety culture and wellness, as a term you hear a lot more now, including diversity and inclusion. How did your training, both formal and experiential, prepare you for this, if at all? And how do you see training should be in the future to make that possible? Can we start with you, please?
Sure. Look, I think I was exposed to all those factors quite early on in my career. I, especially when it comes to, I guess, the safety and risk assessments, I distinctly remember it would have been in about 2005 or 2006, a big change in the way that risk assessments were done on board ships, all the bridge officers need to be involved in it from quite an early, I guess, quite an early stage in our careers. So it meant that much more cognizant of, I guess, risk and safety and what is acceptable and what's not acceptable for any event or evolution that was going to take place. It's when it comes to, I guess, the soft skills of the people side of things. Again, I think, you know, I've experienced quite a lot of that with working for different types of people, having different types of people working for me, being able to, I guess, adapt my style depending on who I was with to get the best out of those people.
Now, the Royal Australian Navy formalises leadership training, if I'm correct. Is that expression soft skills incorporated into that, or is it a consequence of that, or is it?
It's probably incorporated into that a bit, yeah.
Thank you, Josephine.
Yes, I think as a pilot who comes onto the bridge of a ship and spends anything from short pilot duty to 60 minutes to 2.5 hours on that ship, and within the space of a couple of minutes has to gain the confidence of the master, integrate with the bridge team, find their way around the instruments, etc. The soft skills actually are the key. The first 2, 3, 4, 5 years you spend it as a pilot, it's about the hard skills and experience and getting that under your belt. But after that, it's all about communication, building rapport, and trying to create an open environment. And sometimes it's very, very difficult. Sometimes it's very easy, just depending on what you're presented with on the day. And I think that's really the key. And as Jackie said, like, I think so many people in this room have spent much of, particularly the beginning of their career, being very much in the minority on board a ship as being female. And so I think the only way you survive is you learn to deal with people, whether in a confrontational way or in a more positive way. And anyone that's probably would agree that the first phase of your career is definitely the hardest, definitely, because you're young and you have no rank and you have no experience, and et cetera, et cetera. But then as the years go on, all that, you get older, you get wiser, your rank goes up till you become the boss, and no one's going to, you know, give a shit then. But, yeah, so I think subliminally you always learn to the soft skills along the way just to survive to the point to you enter a pilotage career. And I think, honestly, that's the key. And every day of the week yesterday I was with an Indian Sikh master, and you know, the day before that it'll be Chinese and Russian, Ukrainian, Bulgarian, Filipino, whatever. Every religion, race around the world. And I think seafarers, generally speaking, are much more accepting people than the average person on the globe, because they trade around the world, and one day they're in Africa, and one day they're in the Middle East, and one day they're in Australia, and they meet a woman and a Buddhist and a Islamic pilot and a what have you, and they just take it on face value, I think, very much so, and that makes things easier. Yeah.
First truly global industry. Yes.
Definitely from that point. And I think your question was asking about the training back. Mm. So I have to say that at that time when I went through the Canadian Coast Guard, when I was a cadet, we had no formal training or anything concept of soft skills. But as Joe has said and Jackie has said, you learn it because you're in an environment and it's a bit of a survival technique. So you do learn these skills to integrate, and it's a lifestyle choice. It's a career. It really is a career. I believe that there is significant change now, though. And when I was in Canada recently in a similar panel discussion for the Canadian Master Mariners to support women in maritime, we had a presentation from the Canadian Coast Guard where they do a focused effort with the cadets in the first week of the new training program now that talks about diversity and inclusion and sexuality and the whole gender dysphoria. They cover everything. And it's just something that would have been completely unheard of back in the early 80s when I joined the ships. So it's really good to see this happening. The maritime industry has been traditionally very good at diversity. We have multiple cultures and multiple races and everyone working together on a ship, which is really good. What we need to do is ensure that we have this inclusion at the grassroots, and also that diversity recognizes that there are women on board the vessels as well, and ultimately to normalize the concept so we don't have to think about, you know, that we're specifically women on board vessels.
I'd like to open it up to the floor now for any questions or comments on where we've come so far. No, that's fine.
No, Sister Mary, I think, has one.
It's only really a comment. I'm involved in the birth care of the seafarers, so I'm really interested in the birth care of the sea. And the latest survey from Yale suggests that 20% contemplate suicide, self-harm. I know from over the years that the seafarers hold the pilots in the highest regard. I do know sometimes their expectations are unreal. Perhaps the lower ratings, they may have very abusive ship, an abusive system on board, and they presume that the pilot's going to come on board and fix that as well as the human. So I don't want to give you more work. since the NLC has come into being, perhaps there is a little window of opportunity if you see any danger, if you have any hunches that perhaps things aren't right, that you can pass the information on to the likes of us or to anybody. Because you're sort of the out of the court face and you can intuitively pick up things. seafarers absolutely reported in the highest regard. And they see you as a kind of a safety net, even though that's not your job perhaps for them. But maybe there's an opportunity there with this state of play, the mental health.
It's interesting you say that, because from time to time you certainly sense that on board, that there's a genuine fear in interacting with the master. And I've even seen like the second and third officer glancing at each other uncertainly as this presumably tyrant walks on the bridge, and who's courteous enough to the pilot because they need you. But yeah, you're correct. It's you can sense that on every so often. And I must admit, it hadn't occurred to me to take it further. But that's a, yeah, very good idea. Mm. Yeah.
Christopher?
Moving on. Yes, sorry. Yes. the issue of the physical differences with females. So we talk about the whole issue of women in maritime, but there was a reality of the physical prowess of a mate, the strength, size, all those sorts of things, which I had some experiences with in the early days, in the 70s and 80s, of women and ships being set up for men. Did you have any of those sort of circumstances occur, and how did you deal with them, and was it bad thing, or was it a good thing to need to address the situation that that was a function of you being a female?
Well, I can. I was fortunate enough to come into the industry just as hatchboards were thing of the past, union purchase, all that heavy mechanisation and demanning made a lot of the actual physical strength, I guess, less necessary. But I always remember quite distinctly in my first year pre-sea training, I had to start the single cylinder diesel lifeboat engine from cold in winter in the Tamar River, and trying to start that mother with a compression handle was one of my greatest bugbears in life, and eventually did it, but I think it took quite a bit of training, put it that way. But yeah, other than that, I'm fortunate enough to work on the types of ships, and again, deck department, less so than engineering department. There's a lot of you know, hull cleaning work and general, particularly in the first few years, hard work, but not necessarily strength related. I don't know about Navy, but they, yeah.
I think, you know, I, like Joe, I haven't had any issues at all. I think I started going to sea when it was commonplace for women to be at sea. Nobody blinked an eye that there was another female on board. So I certainly have not experienced anything like that myself in my time at sea.
I am so happy to hear that.
Yes.
I had hatchboards. They're heavy. You've got to lift them. First off, you've got the big heavy canvas with all the trucks that you've got to bang in, and then you've got to bang them out again, and then you have to fold this heavy, heavy, ice-encrusted, soaking wet, heavy, thick canvas back off, and then you've got to lift up the boards, and you've got to take them off, and then you have to walk across to lift up the next board, and you're looking right down into the hold. It was hard. We just did it. That's, again, one of those things I did. I think the worst part, though, and it's not just women, because there are some smaller men who go to sea, with survival suits. So we do what we call Marine Emergency Duties Training, MED training. We had to wear a survival suit and jump into a pool. And I was a cadet. So I put the survival suit on. It's a one-size-fit-all survival suit. It's a big Gumby suit. I put it on, jumped into the pool with my girlfriend, and both our feet went straight up. And our heads went straight down, and we almost drowned. Because, of course, the suits are too big. The feet filled with air. Our heads went down, our feet went up, and that was it. So all sorts of issues with PPE. My gloves, we had gloves. It was one size fit all. Again, they were like that much too big for my hands. I'm sitting there trying to do chipping and painting with these gloves. Overalls that we'd hike up, we'd tie with belts, we'd roll up, we'd sew around the bottoms. Now we have a big move to provide protective equipment that fit all sizes. And it's not just women. It's just we were the ones who made it And in fact, it's a survival suit. I made such a big row about it. When I graduated, they gave me my own survival suit, small, and I carried it with me from ship to ship. So not only did I carry my seaman's bag and all of my navigational equipment, I had to pick up my survival suit and carry it up and down the gangway. But I still have it in the garage. It won't be any good anymore. But it was a real issue. I think that is something that all of us from a society can benefit from, because there are small, petite men who go to sea. It's not just women. And we need to have protective equipment that fits us.
It's called one size fits nobody.
Exactly. Yes, I love it. Exactly right. Exactly right. So it's good to hear that there are things moving, but it's not just the heavy lifting. And it was also the radar, the old radars, where they have the hoods on them. And you have to look in the hood, and you put your hands through, and you do all of your parallel indexing. I was too short, and so I had to be on my tiptoes. I couldn't really look in. So what they did is they made a box that I stood on. And after I left, another third mate came who was actually even shorter than me, a guy, and he loved the box that had been made. So I think actually it's beneficial for the entire industry to recognize that human beings come in all shapes and sizes.
Yes. Yeah, I brought it up because that was right in the beginning of when that sea, merchant ships, that was the story that was bandied around. They're too small, they have no muscles, they have no endurance.
I won't get into the bathrooms, but those come later. The toilet facilities that don't exist.
Whether that had been addressed and we're past that.
I think, by the sounds of it, sounds like you're mostly past it, in Navy anyways. From the women in maritime, it sounds like we're not past it in all of the merchant marines. So the women in maritime profiles we're seeing around the world, there are still some ship and some real issues out there.
Mm. Yes. Any comments on that from the floor? Any question? Now, our future as an industry in Australia depends on supply. More people leaving school or college or university and coming into the maritime business. What opportunities would you like to see to encourage young people across the diversity range made aware of careers in maritime? And I'm going to leave Gillian to last because she's very opinionated on this. Jackie, opportunities for young people. How do we make them aware of careers in maritime? In your view.
I think probably promoting it at the high school or at the school level with career fairs and guidance counsellors at school. I certainly wasn't aware that a job in maritime was an option when I was at school. I'd never heard of it before. And it wasn't even really until after I joined the Navy that I understood that there was a maritime industry and that could have been another option to me. So I think quite often, unless you have a family member or a close friend who's worked in the industry, quite often, young children won't know that it exists. So I think at the school level would be a good place to start promoting the industry.
It's interesting that you weren't even aware until you joined the Navy that there was actually. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. The shipping industry globally has long sort of lamented that it's almost invisible to the average person. They don't realise that their everyday goods and services come on those ships that most people don't see. Most ports are completely closed to any kind of casual observation, particularly now with security. So I'd actually like to see some larger companies, such as big container terminals like DP Ports World or Patrick's or whatever, have some open days, or they take school groups through where they can actually look at what goes on. Whether it be a grain terminal, a container terminal, a car terminal down in Port Kembla, or even the Port Authority themselves, where a school group in whatever, it might be a geography subject, who knows, it's related, just to make themselves a little bit more open to kids to realise that, oh my God, this activity goes on around us and helps our society actually function, but very few people actually see that it's there. I think Navy, like when I first sort of dreamt of the idea of, oh, I really like the water, so maybe something on the water would be a good career for me, that's the only one I could think of was the Navy, because everyone's heard of Army, Navy, Air Force. But this was just in the last couple of years before women could serve in a combat position, which basically meant in the Navy, hydro survey vessels or nothing. So that's the only thing that tipped me to research a little bit further. But otherwise, you're right, the average careers guidance person in a high school has no idea about our industry.
Those are excellent points, and just to build on that one about open days, so Fremantle Port does a very, very effective open day every year. We would lovely to see something like that happening here around World Maritime Day, have a ports open day, and actually open up and let people know what's going on. And I know Holly, for example, had no idea how to get into the maritime industry, so she sort of had to make her own way. I would really like to see a multi-pronged approach to this. I would love to see the Women in Maritime Initiative in 2020 look for funding to develop age-appropriate curriculum to bring into the standardized curriculum of schools. So even starting as young as year one, year two, and then have age-appropriate curriculum brought in with a diversity aspect, so it not only talks about maritime, but it also shows diversity in the maritime industry. And that when we get to the high school levels, people can actually been thinking and could have visualized and thought, when I grow up, I want to be a deckhand. When I grow up, I want to be an engineer, a maritime engineer. So that they actually have this image in their head so they can do that. And at the same time as we're getting up there in the fairs, the career fairs, definitely in there, we also get training for the counselors. So that the school counselors, the people who are guiding students into their next generation, actually understand that there is a career. And this industry in Australia exists. It's very vibrant. We have lots of ports. We have lots of domestic vessels. We have pilots. We have maritime operations vessels. We have a lot of activity around the maritime industry, but not necessarily a lot of vision or a lot of visibility for young people to join that. We do also have a very low number of ocean-going vessels or blue water ships. So we do tend to harp on that a lot. We focus on the fact that what we don't have by missing out perhaps what we do have and then starting to see if we can build that industry up and get young people excited about going to sea and see if that actually also helps bring more visibility to the opportunity for positions. Vessel traffic services, harbors, ports, cadet ships on domestic commercial vessels. So I think there's a lot of opportunity out there, but we have to do a focus effort. We have to get it out there and let people know that it's coming.
All those responses I found very encouraging. Mm. Any comments from the floor on getting people into the industry? So that rolls into the next one, to gain sea time. Under the current qualification regime, you need to serve in appropriate ships, often foreign-going ships, ships going blue water international. How do we do that in Australia? Putting a question to the room, but I'll ask Cole what your thoughts might be, Jackie. Might it just be through the Navy? That's the route for so many coming into the maritime industry at the moment.
I guess possibly, but I don't think everyone should have the same path in the industry, because then you're reducing diversity if everyone does the same thing. So I think there needs to be lots of, like, if people need to look at different options, and I think, you know, Jillian was just talking about all the all the domestic commercial vessels that we have as well, and I guess options there, but then I guess it doesn't lead to the tickets, but then again either does Navy vessels either, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tricky one now, given, like, I was lucky, I went through the heyday where you were a sponsored cadet for basically 4 years. These days, anyone that gets taken on any form of cadetship is probably already paid for a pre-sea training course, if not a Master 5, Master 4 certificate. I think it's no doubt already been thought of that some of the training institutes like AMC or Challenger TAFL may gain a partnership with some of the really large international ship owners such as Maersk or MSC or whatever for some sea time avenues there, a bit of a reciprocal arrangement of some manner is probably the best bet. Port Authority New South Wales have taken a step in the last sort of 18 months, or was it almost 2 years ago, they took on a couple of deck cadets and another one just recently, which I honestly thought I'd never see it happen, and hats off to people like Michael Kelly and people in Sydney Ports that put that idea together years ago. And that's a wonderful thing. It'd be great if some other port authorities or larger employers in the Australian shore-based industry, the ports industry, could take that on. But it's a long bow because they're employing people who won't come back to them for 15 or 20 years, realistically, if they're looking at a pilotage career. But it's a start. Yep.
It is a very difficult question, and has been around for quite a while, actually, how to get enough sea time. Sea time that's recognized under tickets. So I guess one of the ways is you could take a look at how is the recognition being done, and is there an equivalency that can be done? I know in Navy, AMSA was looking at trying to draw equivalencies to try and make bridge that gap. There are some organizations internationally that we can look at. Trinity House, for example, I think they sponsor do cadetships. It's difficult to identify how to get the sea time. And I'd actually be really interested to know from out there how many people, how you got your sea time. When I was at the Canadian Coast Guard, my sea time would be all domestic, except for the fact I was on icebreakers. And so I spent a lot of time on icebreakers that were in international waters. So I was able to get some qualifying sea time towards my tickets at the time. Pre-SDCW, we called it Ocean Navigator 1 and Ocean Navigator 2 tickets. But, you know, there is very, very strict. And then once you get your SDCW, you have to keep it up. And you have to keep that relevant. So it's there's not one simple answer. But maybe what we need to take a look at is what kind of maritime industry do we have? Get people interested in that industry and realize that they may be going overseas. They may go on the offshore in order to get some of their sea time. And perhaps even a cadetship might mean that someone goes overseas to get sea time and never even comes back. But they're in the maritime industry. And ultimately, maybe when we need a harbour master, they'll be the ones to put up their hands and say, actually, I wouldn't mind moving back to Australia. I'll take on that role of harbour master. It's just maybe something we have to have a longer vision. There is no easy answer to this.
From the floor, any other ideas before we move this far?
There's a lot of work being shared from the Port Authority. There's a lot of work being done by the Port Authority, New South Wales, in different parts. One of the new initiatives which was started by GM Operations in Sydney, Sarah Marshall, was to work with private boarding to get, I wouldn't say cadetships for blue water, but a berth for Indigenous women. Mm. So we, in the Port Authority, will be sponsoring 4 such positions, and we are now working with industry to sponsor 6 more. So we'll have, what we do is, we'll have 10 Indigenous women coming in through our ranks of marine operations, and that's something that's going to be, that's an ongoing commitment. So there's a lot of work being done. This one's, of course, steered more towards getting the strength of women to the ultimate desire of 50-50, because the female being working quite hard to achieve that. So a lot of work is actually being done and starting to be done, so it's nice to see.
It's very good to hear about that here too. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think Murray has something as well.
Murray.
Yes. Yeah, I just got from experience on the Water of Stars in America. One state who would like to come through and get cadets from casual shipping companies, and then the while they had the maritime 4 ships on the case, so we had quite a good training program. Mm-hmm. But the two masters there at the moment, one started off as a school teacher, worked on a deckhand on the Syro research vessel, and become the IR, and worked his way up in the order through went short his certificates and that. The other one, he started up in the Gulf area running around on barges and small vessels, and managed to get enough sea time to string again to work his way up. Katrina, she started off as a steward, and she's a steward. managed to bridge her way up to get her, which is currently 2 foot 8. And Madeline, she started as a on Greenpeace ships, boats around the place, which we once again got a bigger, as they got bigger and bigger, normally the boats running around with chasing fishermen and whatnot, managed to see time to gradually go up as well. So had a, besides a bit of coming through the normal courses, we had a big diversity. And being a maritime, sort of had a thing for having female personnel on board the ship, so we always had at least one female deck officer, and there's always a number of female COIRs or IRs.
That's very good to hear, actually. Yes, and the IRs, International Regions. Yes, please.
On the back of what Joe mentioned about trying to get some kind of deal done with an international carrier, we've got to be very realistic. We've priced ourselves out of the market. It's not going to have, we're not going to have any Australian ships shortly. It's going that way. We might have a couple of ships down in Antarctica, and we might have a couple of open ships doing research, flying the Australian flag. But the bulk of our ships, blue water ships, have gone, and we're not going to get them back. So being very realistic, I look at ships coming to Australia, whether they're truck carriers, passenger vessels. Many of them are regulars, and I was talking to a Panamanian cadet. I really write Spanish, so I was talking to this Panamanian cadet, and he told me he was on this particular Japanese car carrier because the vessel was flying the Panamanian flag. And they've done a deal, the Panamanian government had done a deal with the Japanese operator to put a couple of cadets on for X amount of time, and they were that way getting a couple of cadets for the Panamanian fleet. I feel we've got oil and light dues that are paid by ships coming out of Australia. We've got cruise ships coming into Australia every summer for the summer season. Why don't we investigate something like that? Say, give P&O an opportunity. Here you get a discount on your oils and lights, but you take 3 cadets for X amount of time, or you put 3 months on the time on board, get them sea time, pick them off, but we'd have to subsidize them because obviously we wouldn't be able to afford their wages because it's a different structure. We also, unfortunately, in our taxation system don't recognize seafarers as an export commodity and as such a valuable revenue source, unlike a lot of other countries. So there are a few things in the background that need to be tweaked, but I feel passenger vessels, car carriers, they're the first ones. What Wilkes and Lyme, they're regulars on here, they go around the world, so much experience and opportunities there, but we need someone in government, someone in APSA, willing to get down to the nitty-gritty and do a deal, and I'm sure there are deals ready to be made, and we get a few young cadets from Australia trained up for the future.
That's extremely encouraging. Perhaps we can talk, Philip. We are running out of time now. Josephine, I know, has another encounter. Very good. Our three accomplished women in maritime, please give them a hand to you. I'd also like to use this occasion to present a certificate to Captain Josephine Clark, who represented Australia and in some way the Nautical Institute, recently attending a conference in Texas. The title of the conference was?
It was called Unite. And it was hosted by Women Offshore, an American body. Yeah.
So this certificate, which is from the Nautical Institute, signed by the Chief Executive in the United Kingdom, express freighted out here, Josephine Clark for advancing women in maritime. Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen.
is the simulator still running upstairs?
The VTS simulator.
Yep. So if anyone's interested, the VTS and the communication simulator is upstairs. We don't have the bridge simulator running, but if you'd like to take a wander around upstairs, you're welcome to. And there's still some food and some drink. For those who I know have to leave, thank you very, very much for coming along.